Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days. We're in a run of 8 consecutive days on pandemic-related issues facing Trump and Biden. Today, one of the most sweeping pandemic policy questions of all, how much should government close businesses and schools to stop the spread? Here is President Trump at last week's debate.
We have to open our country. We're not going to have a country. You can't do this. We can't keep this country closed. This is a massive country with a massive economy. People are losing their jobs. They're committing suicide. There's depression, alcohol, drugs at a level that nobody's ever seen before. There's abuse, tremendous abuse. We have to open our country. You know, I've said it often, the cure cannot be worse than the problem itself.
That was Trump in the debate. Here's Biden the next day.
Once we get our federal, state, and local governments working together, once there's universal masking, enough PPE and testing to go around, science-backed guidance to help us make the right decisions, then we can get our kids back to school safely, our businesses growing, and our economy running again without wasting another minute. As I said last night, I'm not going to shut down the economy. I'm not going to shut down the country. I'm going to shut down the virus.
So how different are they? Well, pretty different on what would make the cure worse than the disease, so to speak. Back in March, with seniors being the Americans most at risk of death from the virus, or among the Americans most at risk, the Republican Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, put it even more starkly.
No one reached out to me and said, as a senior citizen, are you willing to take a chance on your survival in exchange for keeping the America that all America loves for your children and grandchildren? And if that's the exchange, I'm all in.
Keep the economy open, even if it means more seniors like him have to die. The Lieutenant Governor of Texas, Dan Patrick, on Fox. So we have a moral, economic, and public health question for the ages. How much COVID risk reduction for how much economic pain? Or conversely, as the Lieutenant Governor had it there, how many people should we allow to die to preserve the old normal for everyone else? With me now, New York Times economics correspondent Jim Tankersley. He has reported extensively over the last decade for various news organizations on the stagnation of the American middle class, including in his new book, The Riches of This Land, The Untold True Story of the American Middle Class. He also had a Times article on Friday called Iowa Never Locked Down. Its economy is struggling anyway. Jim, thanks for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor and privilege.
Let's start with your article about Iowa. How little did it lock down? How quickly did it reopen?
Well, Iowa is one of those states that never really had a lockdown. They have not had the widespread economic restrictions. They didn't have a full stay-at-home order. They allowed restaurants and movie theaters and hair salons and bars to reopen starting in May, which was earlier than most other states. So they were sort of at the forefront of this idea that fewer restrictions is what we need for a faster economic rebound.
And you write that Iowa did see an initial pop in employment and sales when it reopened from even the minimal lockdown that it had imposed. But more cautious states, you write, have seen faster economic rebounds by many measures. What are you comparing?
Well, I mean, what we're doing is we're looking at a variety of employment measures in comparable industries. You know, the sort of industries that have been really affected by lockdowns are, for example, hospitality and restaurants and just service-based things. Anywhere where you have to go outside your home and in person show up and put yourself at risk of contracting the virus to spend money and do business. And so when you compare on those measures, other states have come back faster than Iowa, including some states with very strict lockdowns early on. And I mean, there's a reason behind all this. The reason is it doesn't look like people are only limited from doing that sort of business by what the government is telling them. They are limited by their own tolerance of risk for whether it's safe to go and shop.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize that because the research you cite leans toward a conclusion that most of the economic pain the country is feeling is not from the government's ordering closures, but from Americans voluntarily pulling back on things like flying and dining as individual decisions to protect themselves from the virus. But how much is there data to tease apart the voluntary from that mandated by government?
So there is a variety of studies that have started to look at this. It's tricky. I think we should be honest about the fact that we don't know for sure exactly what all these things look like yet in the data, and it's going to take a while to get the sort of comprehensive, disaggregation of activity. But you know, some of the early research, for example, from the University of Chicago, suggested that only a very small fraction of when you looked at comparable counties across state lines, some which were under restrictions and some which weren't, that very few of the differences appear to be related to the restrictions, and that really what you see is that it's people's tolerance for risk. So I think that the early evidence so far has been suggestive of the idea that government can send a signal to people about whether they, you know, people should think it's safer not to go outside, and they can, you know, force certain businesses to close or to stay closed. But that when the government lifts those restrictions, it is not just a green light that sends everybody back, at least in a long-term basis, to just their old habits.
And conversely, how much extra disease, if any, in places that haven't locked down or reopened quickly?
Well, I mean, you sort of expect it to go hand in hand. And so this is, when people are taking more risks, you would think that there is a greater chance of the virus spreading. I think we saw that in particular in the spring when some states like South Carolina and Texas opened faster, and then saw this sort of what I guess we now think of as the second wave, particularly as like tourists flock there. And then people kind of adjust their behaviors. And so now what we see is a big surge in the virus spreading across all sorts of states, whether there's lockdowns or not. Really only a few places up in the Northeast, you know, Maine and Vermont, New Hampshire, that appear to be not experiencing the same kind of surge as everywhere else. So I think we're learning that, it is difficult to control this virus, but that right now it is having both profound economic consequences still, no matter what the restrictions are. Like a state like South Dakota is still experiencing both a surge in the virus and depressed economic activity, even though it doesn't really have the kind of restrictions that other states have. So, you know, we can see that it is really hand in hand. As one economist told me this spring, the virus is the boss in the economy right now.
So, listeners, if you're just joining us, we're in issue 27, down the home stretch here in our 30 issues in 30 days pre-election series. Today on the question that's one of the most sweeping pandemic policy questions of them all, how much should government close businesses and schools to stop the spread? And we dealt with schools separately yesterday. We're talking now about businesses, economic activity in particular. And listeners, we'll ask the question of you as we continue with New York Times correspondent Jim Tankersley. How much locking down are you in favor of right now as the virus surges again? 646-435-7280. 646-435-7280. When is government-mandated economic closure justified, in your opinion? When, if ever, is the cure worse than the disease, in your opinion, in terms of public health or poverty or anything else? What's the moral equation, as you see it, between life as normal for most people and more deaths of seniors and other vulnerable Americans? As the lieutenant governor of Texas said in that clip, he's willing to take the risk of, as a senior himself, to volunteer for that heightened risk in exchange for more normal lives for younger Americans? Or is it a false choice? Can the vulnerable be protected through policy while reopening more broadly for everyone else. Or any questions you have for New York Times economics correspondent Jim Tankersley, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. And Jim, I know you're an economics correspondent, not a public health one per se, but we should point out that while most epidemiologists think the cure is not worse than the disease, there is a group of dissenters that issued what they call the Great Barrington Declaration, led by some public health professors who are also, I gather, seen as serious people, including epidemiologists such as Martin Kulldorff from Harvard and Sunetra Gupta from Oxford. Part of what they write is that the results of lockdowns, quote, include lower childhood vaccination rates, worsening cardiovascular disease outcomes, fewer cancer screenings, and deteriorating mental health, leading to greater excess mortality in years to come, with the working class and younger members of society carrying the heaviest injustice, unquote. And again, we say this is a much smaller group of public health experts than those who feel the other way. But have you reported on the Great Barrington Group or the evidence for the competing claims, especially as it pertains to working class Americans being more at risk?
Well, I mean, I think that the most important corner where you hear that argument right now is actually coming from inside the White House. I had an interview a couple weeks ago for a big story I did on the White House's view on testing and whether we should be expanding testing, which is something that a lot of economists have called for as a tool to get the economy back on its feet faster. The theory being, you know, if you test more, then people will know where it's safe and where it's not safe to go, and we can get more economic activity more quickly. But the White House opposes that idea. Scott Atlas, who was one of the president's big healthcare advisors, Stanford University, Hoover Institution doctor, I had an interview with him, and he told me, you know, first off, we should not be testing more people and taking what he says, you know, are people who are at low risk of dying from the disease out of the labor force if they test positive. But that secondly, it's just going to lead to more lockdowns, which he says, I mean, he told me, quote, that history would record this area very harshly as a massive, egregious failure of experts, which has particularly harmed middle class and low income people. And the argument there that Dr. Atlas and others in the White House have really latched onto is that it is government and the fear that government has instilled in people to the virus that has chilled the economy, both through formal lockdowns and by warning people about the dangers. And that actually, you know, the argument that the White House is making is it's pretty safe for most people. Dr. Atlas, to me, cited the statistic of a very low mortality rate for people under the age of 70. And the idea is people should just be going about their daily life as if this is nothing different than the flu. And I think that is, a very sharp contrast with the surge that we're seeing in concern and among epidemiologists over the rising case numbers and hospitalizations in the country right now from the virus.
And that conflict, that dispute among different groups of people, the White House on one side, most epidemiologists and other public health experts on the other, leads inevitably to the question that I think Helen on Staten Island is calling in with. Helen, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Thank you. I don't feel we should put the whole context of the coronavirus in this ethical, this unethical context, frankly, Brian, although I'm very, very much a longtime fan of your program. In this case, I don't feel that they can make a case. Also, we should use Asia as our paradigm of the way things are run properly. Number one, they accept alternative and complementary medicine as approaches to dealing with COVID. For example, homeopathy, which is less heavy-handed than the vaccine paradigm. The other issue here are the ethics of allowing older people to be sacrificed in terms is ridiculous, because older people offer wisdom, and our brain trust in this country is very much comes from the older people and their experience and wisdom. That's all I have to say.
Helen, thank you very much for your call. And besides the anti-vax aspect to that call, which we'll deal with on another day, what she brought up at the end about this idea of potentially sacrificing the lives of older people to keep society otherwise as a whole going forward. That's what the lieutenant governor of Texas brought up so starkly. And I want to focus on how seniors and other high-risk Americans are accounted for in the Trump and Biden approaches. The president brings it up all the time, though without many specifics, like this at a senior residence in Florida recently.
Democrats, we want to open their states, open up your states, and we're very careful with our seniors, and that's different, but open up your states, get it back.
We're very careful with our seniors. That's different. But he didn't say how. So here's what Vice President Pence said in his 60 Minutes interview this week.
You know, one of the things we apprehended early on is that seniors, particularly those with serious underlying health conditions, are the most at risk for a serious outcome if they contract the coronavirus. And so families may make a decision that certain elderly family members might take a pass. But I think the difference between President Trump and me and some of the public voices in this debate over the last year has been we trust the American people.
So, Jim, they don't get very specific on how they can protect seniors if their policy is to let the virus run through society, because they think the cure is worse than the disease. Pence there puts the responsibility on every individual or family to make choices. That doesn't seem to me to be a policy response to how much economic closure is required to keep how many more seniors from getting fatal cases. There's no policy in that statement to protect seniors, just individual choice and what he called trusting the American people. Am I missing something?
No, I think the one other thing that their advisors have talked about is just doing, much more rigorous testing around vulnerable populations, particularly nursing homes. But what we've seen in the last month is that doesn't seem to work. We haven't been able to build a firewall around nursing homes. My former colleagues at The Washington Post have a great story last week about La Crosse, Wisconsin, where there was a surge in cases related to college students, which now seems to have worked its way into nursing homes. It has been really difficult. This has been true in a lot of parts of the country and a lot of parts of the world. It has been really difficult to isolate elderly populations, and it makes sense why. People work in those populations. They have caregivers. They have all sorts of ways in which the outside world gets in and out of those bubbles at nursing homes, and they are incredibly vulnerable populations. And I think the other thing is that many senior citizens work and need to work. And so we do not have a public policy plan right now that sort of provides income support so that seniors don't have to go to work when they are at high risk. And so if that was going to be your plan, there might be different policy ways you could approach it. But I don't think we're seeing that right now across the country.
And the government doesn't seem to require it. For example, in the education workforce, New York City allows any teacher 65 years or older to voluntarily choose remote teaching. I was speaking to a relative of mine on the phone who teaches at a private college. I will keep the name of the college private. But that college does not offer the same benefit to their professors. In other words, the 65-year-old or older college professor at that school does not automatically get the privilege of teaching remotely in order to protect themselves from COVID, even in a college environment where students are there and we know college students are getting it and passing around a lot. If the government mandated that as public policy, workers over 65 have to be given every possible accommodation to stay home and not lose their jobs, that would be policy. And so I looked this up on the Biden campaign website, and I did find one thing in its Reopen the Economy page. On its Reopen the Economy page, it says require companies to make specific arrangements for workers who either face a high risk of health complications themselves or have family members who do, or let the employees receive unemployment insurance if they cannot work safely. So, Jim, it seems to me that's a policy proposal, and we do not have a policy like that in effect right now, correct?
We don't. I mean, there are definitely enormous differences between the policy proposal that the Biden campaign has put out and what the president is practicing now and what he's talking about, you know, continuing to be the policy going forward. And I think that you've hit on an important part of it. I think testing is another very important part. You know, Biden wants to, you know, do several million tests a day nationwide, set up sort of a national test and trace plan, including 100,000 people across the country and sort of like a public health jobs corps to be working on these sorts of things, to do contract tracing. The Trump team just doesn't think that that would be effective, and they've resisted it, and it's been an issue in stimulus talks with Democrats who want a national testing strategy and have found resistance from the White House. So these are big policy differences, and they really are important to the economy. They are important for public health, obviously, but I think that the approach that a lot of economists are taking here is you are not going to be able to have the kind of economic activity, particularly in the service sector, on airplanes, tourism, anything like that, until you have people really confident again that they are, at low risk of contracting the virus because they know where it is.
And so when Vice President Pence says in that clip from 60 Minutes on Sunday, "We trust the American people," part of that is saying government is not going to mandate these safety standards for the workplace if we stay in power.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. One of the big things that one of the big Republican pushes in the stimulus talks has been for liability protections for companies that that have workers come back and have customers in a time of COVID. They want to make it very difficult or have set a very high bar for people to sue those companies that are open. And so I think there's just, like you said, just two very competing approaches here.
We have a few more minutes here on issue 27 in our 30 Issues in 30 Days pre-election series. We are asking one of the most sweeping pandemic policy questions: how much should government close businesses to stop the spread? We're getting views on this from the reporting of Jim Tankersley, New York Times economics correspondent, and Lou on Staten Island. You're on WNYC. Hi, Lou.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Listening to the three clips you just played of the vice president, the former vice president, the vice president, the president, you cannot solve a problem by denying the existence of the problem in the first place. Before the pandemic hit, the president was giving intelligence reports as to the severity and rapidity of this virus. He agreed with our journalists how severe the virus could be. Then he comes publicly in front of the American people and he downplays the virus. He lied about it. So when the vice president said they trust the American people, you cannot trust people when you're hiding the facts from them. That is the whole core of the issue here right now. They hated it, they downplayed it. By the time the travel ban was instituted against the Chinese, more than 10,000 people have passed through JFK bringing the virus with them. And that's why the problem has been ever since. You cannot downplay it and you say you trust the American people. No, give the American people the fact. They are intelligent people. I agree with the first caller from Staten Island. Our elders, our seniors, these are the people with the brains, their experience. You can't sacrifice them. We need them. But first and foremost, you have to be honest with the American people. Don't double talk them, say you trust them, but then you're hiding the truth from them. So what the basis of the public policy now? That's what the problem is. These people are, I don't know whether it is incompetence or just pure don't care or liars, but this is the worst administration in the 40 years of being in this country, Brian. These people are terrible.
Lou, thank you for your call. Keep calling us. We appreciate your views. And Ross in White Plains, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ross.
Hi, I agree with the last caller. Rich tourists returning from Europe brought this back to us. But under the Fifth Amendment to our U.S. Constitution, if government action is taken for the common good, individuals and businesses are entitled to just compensation if they're damaged. Are we the taxpayers on the hook and liable for the damages done by this massive lockdown? And I want to make one suggestion. I think there should be a class action suit against the college dropout, Bill Gates, who considers himself an expert. Thank you very much.
Well, Ross, how would you do it? I'm going to take you seriously here. If there should be compensation under the takings clause, in effect. What is the relief bill, a robust relief bill? Oh, Ross hung up. Okay. But let's take them seriously, Jim. For you as an economics correspondent, if government is mandating closures, which yep. loses millions and millions of people their jobs, or if they're the owners, their businesses, in many cases, what responsibility does the government have, and how do they approach that?
Well, I think that it's a very valid point, particularly early in the pandemic. It's a valid point that the government did, and particularly state and local governments, did force a lot of businesses to shut down. And the idea was that they were going to step in with assistance to the businesses that were hurt, you know, for example, through the Paycheck Protection Program in Congress. The reality was it didn't reach everyone who needed it, not even close. And so there's a really legitimate argument that those businesses, you know, some of whom went out of business immediately, were harmed by that government action. But I think what we've seen in the months since is that reopening has not brought back the customers for a lot of these businesses. And in fact, it's going to be difficult to prove that, you know, in many cases, that the government's action did much in terms of stopping people from going to those businesses. In other, we can see it in the data. There are places where people just stopped going to restaurants even before the government said, you can't go to restaurants anymore. Restaurants can't be open. So you can't sue fear, right? You can't sue under the takings clause to get to get money from the government because of fear of the virus spreading. So I think that any sort of legal case here would have to sort of do what we were talking about in the very beginning and tease out the actual economic damages from government restrictions as opposed to changes in consumer behavior from fear of the virus.
Last thing, have you looked at Europe in this respect? If we're talking about how much lockdown saves how many lives? Much harder lockdowns than the U.S. in general, originally, but the virus is roaring back over there now, too, at similar rates to here.
Yeah, I mean, the countries that have done the best on this have for the most part, been Asian and Pacific countries. And it has, you know, there's a lot of things that run through those. I think, you know, particularly like a country like South Korea had an incredibly robust testing trace program early on. There's a much more prevalent mask wearing in those countries. But I do think that Europe is a cautionary tale here. I mean, in America right now is a cautionary tale. We have a lot of resurgence of the virus as people have changed their behaviors. And in part, it's just sort of like naturally human tendencies at play. Things don't look so bad, so you start going out and doing things again. But it hasn't entirely gone. The virus hasn't entirely gone away. And as people resume more of their daily normal, quote, normal activity, they are exposing themselves to more risk. And then it starts to spread again. And that's why, you know, early on in the pandemic, a lot of experts were telling me we expect to see this in waves. And I think that's what's happened. And it's in part been, you know, the waves that come from people starting to feel like it's less of a risk, going back out, finding it's still a risk, then contracting their own activity again. And I think Europe shows us that as well as the U.S.
Yeah. So your book is called The Riches of This Land, The Untold True Story of the American Middle Class. I wonder how you see this chapter, which hopefully will be a pretty temporary chapter, fitting into the bigger picture. I mean, NPR had a story this morning about many Americans withdrawing from the workforce reluctantly but voluntarily, like you've been reporting on, because of remote learning, especially women. But here in New York City, where families have a choice of a hybrid model in person some days a week, a large majority have chosen remote learning anyway, and disproportionately it's the lower income families who are keeping their kids home more, the opposite of what one might expect from a purely economic model. So do you have a take on the economic versus safety calculus that middle and working class people are making here, and how does it fit into your untold true story of the American middle class?
I really appreciate that question. My answer is that if you were to design a recession and a health crisis that was like a heat-seeking missile to target the people we most need to rebuild the American middle class, you'd basically design this one. Unfortunately, it's women and it's Hispanic and Black Americans and immigrants who are history shows us the crucial drivers of middle-class prosperity in America, and they are the ones disproportionately hurt here. They're disproportionately exposed to the virus, they are disproportionately dying from the virus, and they are disproportionately economically impacted by everything you just mentioned, both kids staying at home and so having to drop out of the labor force, or having frontline jobs that have either exposed them to more risk or have been shut down. They work for businesses that shut down because their demand has gone away. Those groups are in a crisis. I mean, what's happening with women in particular, with the plunge in labor force participation, is a short-term and long-run absolute calamity for the economy. And when policymakers start sorting out the real policies to help us rebound long-term from this, they're going to have to address that because those critical workers are losing wealth. They're losing income. They are exposing themselves to high health risks, and then their kids are suffering in remote learning right now, and they're losing the chance to build the human capital that helps them climb into the middle class as adults. So I think this is very, very bad for the health of the American middle class, and actually have a little bit about that in the book, which I finished up just as the pandemic was starting.
Tomorrow, folks, in our 30 Issues in 30 Days pre-election series, it's on to issue 28, which is going to be all about how to reduce the disparity in the outcomes of the pandemic for this next wave that is starting to surge. For today, we wrap up issue 27, how much economic lockdown for how much public health gain. We thank New York Times economics correspondent Jim Tankersley. And he is also author of the new book, The Riches of This Land, The Untold True Story of the American Middle Class. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.